Right now on this portion of Vocal Point, we're going to be talking about the economy and particularly energy. Our guest is Megan O'Sullivan, who is a Harvard professor, and she's the author of a new book called Windfall. And here's the subtitle, How the New Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Powers. The website for the book, by the way, is windfallthebook.com. Dr. O'Sullivan, it's great to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Sherry. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Sure. Now, your exact title at Harvard is quite a mouthful. You are the Jean Kirkpatrick Professor of the Practice of International Affairs and Director of Geopolitics of Energy Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School. By the way, I once, as a TV producer, which is my full-time job, I once did an interview in the Jean Kirkpatrick's office in a D.C. office when she was associated with Jack Kemp and then also Bill Bennett. I was interviewing Bill Bennett. This was about 20 years ago, more than 20 years
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
That's my little... Okay, so tell us all about why you wrote this book and what is the main point of it.
Sure. There are lots of sub-themes and sub-stories, but the real big picture of why I wrote the book has to do with the fact that in today's world, in order to understand what's happening, you know, why one country is acting a certain way, another country acting another way, we really need to understand not just foreign policy and national security, but we also need to understand energy markets and how they're working. So my plea to my reader is to really think about incorporating energy into your analysis when you're trying to figure out why the world is working the way that it does. And then secondarily, I make the case, which many of your listeners will be familiar with, that because of the big changes in the American energy landscape over the last decade, looking at the world with an energy lens as well as a foreign policy lens is more important than ever.
Okay, here's a statement that you have in your book. By World War II, access to oil influenced military strategy as much as any single consideration. Now, that's a very, bold statement that you're making, because World War II was the greatest conflict in the history of the world, and, so many millions died, and there's so many different components to it, and yet oil was a huge factor. That's something we don't normally think about. How is that so?
Well, I can give you two examples quickly, but really it is interesting because oil was at the center point of the strategy. It was relevant for all militaries that were fighting, but it was of particular concern to the Japanese and the Germans, who had an idea that actually they needed to have physical control of oil in order for their militaries to be competitive and capable. And the best example is maybe the Pearl Harbor example, is that you actually had a U.S. embargo on oil exports to Japan. At the time, the U.S. was a big exporter of oil, and Japan got a lot of its oil from the United States. And with that embargo of oil, the Japanese became more and more desperate for oil resources, in part to train their military, but also to keep their economy going. And so they looked around the world, and they decided that the best place for them to acquire these resources was in what was called the East Indies, but today's Indonesia, say.
Okay.
And they looked at what the obstacles were. And their big fear was that if they went for a land grab in that part of the world, that they would be thwarted by the U.S. forces in Pearl Harbor. And so that led to the bombing of Pearl Harbor, which in fact is, as we all know, the key thing that brought the United States into the war itself. So that's just one example of how energy and access to energy really shaped a key moment in World War II. And history is replete with these. We have so many cases where history has really driven, particularly in wartime, but also in peacetime, strategies of countries.
You know, that's so true. You think about, for example, all the unrest in the Middle East. A lot of that's related to oil, isn't it? Because, you know, what just happened and happened over there but didn't impact the rest of us, it didn't matter. I mean, they had to deal with all the conflicts and so forth. But because oil was so important and oil became a big factor for the Middle East, growth and development, then it impacted all of us and continues to impact all of us.
Well, there is a whole body of academic literature, but it's supported by the real world, which suggests that countries that are very, very dependent on resources, oil being the obvious one but not the only one, have, you know, develop along different lines. And the theory is basically that if you have a very, you know, big endowment of a natural resource, it allows a government to become, you know, more authoritarian because they don't need to rely on taxes of their citizens, so they don't need to be responsive to their needs of their citizens. And they have a lot of resources that they can use to build up repressive elements of their government, and they have resources which they can use to buy off the opposition. So there's some pretty strong evidence, or at least very strong theories, that at least some countries have kind of developed along the ways they have, in large part because of their oil endowments.
All right. Now, you say in the book that there's a new energy abundance. Can you comment on that?
Sure. And that's really the key point of the book as well, is basically to get the reader to understand that we're in a world of energy that looks very different than it did just 10 years ago. And this abundance, some people might say, oh, maybe this is talking about renewables. Renewables is part of it, but the abundance in renewables, I think, is the story for the future. The story of today is really a story about abundance of oil and natural gas. And a lot of that really began in the United States, where in the last, say, 10 years or so, American ingenuity really brought to the fore new technologies that allowed the United States to produce vast quantities of oil and natural gas that exist in America, but people never thought would be commercial to produce. So the real genius has been finding ways of producing these big resources at a price that makes sense, that works with the markets. So that has transformed the United States from being a massive importer of oil in particular, and potentially an importer of natural gas, to now being the world's largest producer of oil and natural gas combined.
Well, okay, are you talking about things like fracking?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, fracking is...
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, Hollywood is opposed to that, right?
Well, there are many people who are either opposed to it just full stop, or have very serious reservations about it. And I would say, and I discuss this in the book in some detail, that there are good reasons to be nervous about fracking, which is actually a combination of technologies, because of the potential environmental hazards that could come along with it. And we know, actually, people have been fracking various resources for a long time, but we know that there are real concerns. They have to do with wastewater, they have to do with methane emissions, they have to do with seismic activity. But the real debate, I think, needs to be, in the book I say, you know, we need a Goldilocks solution. So we need something that's not too hot and not too cold. So we need to navigate between the extremes of saying, you know, companies should be able to frack their heart out and without any constraints, or saying this is something that should not be allowed anywhere in the United States. That the best outcome is somewhere in the middle, where America can benefit from the enormous economic potential and the enormous strategic benefits of these technologies without creating, you know, too many risks to our environment. And I think that's a conversation that actually can and should happen. Doesn't happen as much in our country as it should be, because these issues tend to be very polarizing. But I do believe there is a Goldilocks solution, which involves a certain amount of regulation to ensure that we're still able to reap the benefits, but without undue risks to the environment.
Now, some people, especially, you know, let's say many on the left, for example, will highlight things like recycling and wind and solar and so forth. But it's my understanding that if you take all those efforts combined, it's still, you know, it would be less than 5% or whatever of the energy needs that we have would be produced through such means. So at the end of the day, we still do need oil and gas. And what you're saying is that there are newer and better ways to get those things to us in a, you know, in a more affordable way. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that's definitely true. Just some statistics that your listeners may not be aware of, that currently more than 80% of the world's energy needs are met by fossil fuels, by oil, natural gas, or coal. So it's true that renewables, I think renewables have a very bright future, and I'm hopeful that we will transition in my lifetime to a more sustainable energy future. But right now, there's a very, very long way to go. So renewables, particularly solar and wind, are growing very quickly, and that's a good thing, but from a very, very small base. So there's still a lot of time that in technology that needs to be developed to until we get to a point where renewables are really a dominant source. The other thing which is really important and maybe even less appreciated is the fact that right now, solar, wind, other forms of renewable energy are good substitutes for natural gas and coal, but they're not substitutes for oil, because 95% of the transportation in the United States and a similar percentage worldwide is actually based on oil or oil-based products. So, you know, until you find a way of getting natural gas or renewables into the energy mix, until you break that link between transportation and oil, you can have all the renewables that you like, but you'll still have this big dependence on oil. So there are still some really big technological advances that need to be made before we can really start thinking about a world in which renewables are substituting for oil.
All right. How about a couple of comments about coal, since that part of the economy, I mean, coal miners and those reliant on coal have been hit very hard, you know, in the last few years.
Yeah, well, they've been hit very hard for a number of reasons, but probably the most important one has to do with this exact conversation, that this new set of technologies allowed for the production of enormous new quantities of natural gas in the United States at very low prices. And so it just became more economical if you were running a power plant. It became more economical for you to run that power plant on natural gas rather than coal. And so we saw over the last 10 years a huge switching away from coal towards natural gas. And this was driven by the market. This was not necessarily any government policy. It was simply that it just made better economic sense. Now, you know, there's an effort going on by the administration now to try to reverse that or to try to rejuvenate the coal economy. I'm skeptical that that will work, in part because a lot of people making these investments today, they look at the big picture and they think about, you know, does coal have a better future than natural gas? And it's very hard to make that case. So a lot of people, I think, look at the fact that they're confident there's going to be there's going to be low prices for natural gas for a long period of time. And, you know, unless we get in a world where we're going to try to be subsidizing coal over natural gas, you know, I think that a lot of investors will take a safer bet and plan for a future that is maybe a post-President Trump future, where, again, the economy and the government goes back to a position where it's more encouraging of natural gas than it is of coal.
Hmm. All right, we have half a minute to wrap up. What's the bottom line story here about energy and our economy?
Sure. I would bring it back to, you know, energy is very, very tied to global politics. And this new change in America's energy fortunes has really meant that it has changed America's, one, sources of power, and two, it's changed the strategic landscape of the world. And this has been largely to America's advantage, and I think we're only beginning to think about how to take advantage of this really new, exciting, and positive moment for the United States.
All right. Hey, thank you so much for being with us. Again, we've been talking with Megan O'Sullivan, and she is a Harvard professor and the author of the book called Windfall on the subject of energy. And the website is windfallthebook.com. Dr. O'Sullivan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.